Saturday, January 28th, morning session.
I think we should begin with somebody everybody knows here, Bruce Willis. And I think I'd just like to say a few things, probably give you a few little known facts about his background. He got his LLB from McGill University and started practicing in Ontario and almost moved to the area where I practice in Ontario, Midland, but he made the right choice and moved to the Northwest Territories, Hay River, and practiced there for a year or so. During that time, he was the first president of the Hay River Broadcasting Society. And then he came to Whitehorse. He initially was in practice with Lord Phelps, and then moved to the present firm that he's with, Preston Willis and Leach. He has been very active in the community and in the Law Association, the Canadian Bar Association. He was, of course, the president of our local Bar Association, and received recently a federal QC. I mentioned that in distinguishment of some QCs from provinces such as Ontario, which are somewhat in doubt at the moment, and I know a bit about that. And he has spent a great deal of time and effort in researching the subject which he's going to speak to you on, and I'm sure that his comments will be of some interest and application, interestingly enough, to a private practitioner. Well, Bruce.
Thank you, Gordon. Because of time constraints and general interest, I'm not going to deal with the FIAT, except it may come up in passing. It's in the paper. The reason that sort of prompted this was in 1987, in the case of Rao versus various people, we were challenged by the fact that we had not first sought permission from the government before commencing action, did not have the jurisdiction to proceed. That issue had been raised before, it still remains, and of course the question is only the Crown, which I'll cover briefly in the paper, can raise that issue. Now I understand in the Northwest Territories, the position of the Northwest Territories government is they take the position that they're the Crown, they have Crown priority, all the privileges of the Crown, all the prerogatives of the Crown. I suspect that that is a similar position considering the challenge made in 87 of the Yukon government. The main point then in the paper, which I'll be covering this morning, will be to look at the constitutional basis of Yukon presently, look at the arguments and authorities for the proposition that there is no Yukon Crown, then we'll look at the authorities and cases that suggest that there is or can be argued a Yukon Crown, and then I'll do with my conclusion, then we'll open into some general discussion. I should say that the three major authorities, I suppose if you'd use that term, for the Yukon government's arguments were the two papers that David Elliott did and the one paper that Jim Almstrom did, and I do review those and comment on those. Those, I believe, were commissioned by and published by the Yukon government. So that the first question is, the older judicial view of the Yukon was it was not unlike a municipality, and with the decision of Daniel Saint-Jean and the government of Yukon, the argument has been put forward because of the remarks of Mr. Justice Meyer after finding that the Yukon government was not a department of the government of Canada, that it was an infant province. Some council and some people have suggested that that is a good, strong authority to support the proposition that the Yukon government, in fact, is the Crown. And that still, of course, doesn't answer the question that if we are, in fact, an infant province, do we have Crown status? I understand in the Northwest Territories, in their actions against the government of the Northwest Territories, they do not sue something called the Government of the Northwest Territories. They simply sue the commissioner. Older Yukon cases that I've looked at were in actions against the commissioner. More recently, in some cases, it's been styled the Government of the Yukon Territory and the Commissioner of the Yukon Territory as chief executive officer. To my knowledge, no one has yet just simply sued the Government of the Yukon Territory. The commissioner is always added as a party. I guess the first starting point is, what is the Crown? I mean, notwithstanding that the Yukon government has powers, and because of the Yukon Act has many powers that are similar to a province, can it be considered judicially to be the Crown or be the province? The Crown is, as Hogg has described, the convenient symbol for the state. The Crown is the state of the government, but he does not comment on what is a territory in those remarks in his textbook. And in the paper you'll see some other comments on what is the Crown from various authorities. Because you really come down to this: a municipality is a government. It can sue, it can contract, it can be sued, but no one would suggest that it is the Crown. And where's the cutoff point? Now, there is no clear statutory enactment of the Yukon government that sets out procedures in suing the Yukon government. We're really in a vacuum here. The Crown Liability Act excludes us. The Federal Crown Liability Act excludes us. Unlike many municipalities that have procedural requirements in bringing action, the Yukon Act is silent. The Yukon Act does not deal with actions against the Yukon government as a procedural matter, nor has the Yukon government passed any statute. Where does that leave us? I guess the first point we should look at, first of all, is what is the constitutional status? And I'd like to briefly look at some of the supporting documents, because really there's very little to suggest that there are any quote-unquote constitutional documents that establish the territory as a province has been established, or the Canadian government was established. Under Section 4 of the Yukon Act, it's the commissioner who administers the territory under instructions given to him by the governor and council. And also, the commissioner and council, or the Yukon legislature, is limited under Section 17 of the Yukon Act to make ordinances for the government of the territory. They have to be subject to the Yukon Act. They have to be subject to any other act of the Parliament of Canada. And also, Section 22 requires a copy of every ordinance to be transmitted to the governor in council within 30 days after the passing by the legislature, and may be disallowed by the governor and council within 2 years. And I think in discussion we'll talk about what happened, I think, in 1980 with the Sheets Act, and whether or not this will happen again, or have we reached the point where they won't. And we'll look at the Pokiak and Steen case, where the Northwest Territories government didn't do it, and the Supreme Court of the Northwest Territory says that they don't have to. So that's an interesting point on whether or not our territorial government still is required to do that. A major change took place in 1979 when the notorious Jake Epp wrote the notorious or infamous or famous Epp letter, which has set the Yukon quite forward in one of the stronger arguments that it's a territory. And there were specific directions given to the commissioner at that time. Well, we certainly know that the Epp letter exists, copies float around. And of course, in our discussion, I'd like to turn to the Bassford letter and see what happened with respect to the Department of Justice, Yukon government's ability to take on the, effectively the Crown Attorney's role with territorial ordinances. What happens when those letters go astray? Do they still exist? Is Ottawa going to give another one? But we certainly have the Epp letter. In the first direction was that the commissioner was to accept the advice of counsel in all matters which were delegated to the commissioner and counsel provided, now here's an important point, provided that they met the requirements of Section 17 of the Act. That means subject to this Act and any other Canadian statute of the Parliament of Canada. And by authority of Section 4 of the Yukon Act, the Commissioner was instructed to request to the territorial leader that, quote, he shall constitute and appoint a body known as the Cabinet or the Executive Council, which will have as its members those elected representatives of the Territorial Council who are designated from time to time by the government leader who enjoy the confidence of the Council. Now, as a result of the UP letter, orders in Council were passed that stated they were pursuant to those directions under the provisions of Section 4 of the Yukon Act. Now, I'd like to turn to arguments that I think I've summarized, and there may be more, there may be additional arguments, against the proposition that there is a Yukon Crown. The first turning point in our discussion is the Crown Liability Act, which deals with actions against the federal crown, which defines crown as Her Majesty the Queen in right of Canada. It also defines servant as including an agent, but specifically excludes any person appointed or employed by or in the authority of an ordinance of the Yukon Territory or the Northwest Territories from the operation of the Crown Liability Act. So we're specifically excluded, but we've defined Her Majesty for the purposes of that statute. Now, I'd like to refer to a case that's not in the paper, although it will be. It's a helpful case that Mr. Binney directed myself to last night. It's a case that in the last few years, everybody seems to have not paid particular attention to. It's the Yukon Court of Appeal in the case of Regina versus Peters. It's a 57 WWR, page 727. It's a 1966 case. And the argument was by appeal of the then Territorial Court or Supreme Court on the issue of an Indian who was charged with unlawfully consuming liquor, and he was charged contrary to the liquor ordinance of the time. And the defense was, well, that was covered by under the Indian Act, and therefore there was no jurisdiction of the territorial government to touch that subject matter. And the Court of Appeal, in its finding, held that the Indian Act, as amended, made provisions for the use and possession of intoxicants by Indians, and therefore made it an offense to possess intoxicants off reserve. And therefore, they held that the Yukon Liquor Act, or ordinance of the day, fell within the exception of the then Section 87 of the Indian Act, which said, subject to the terms of any treaty and any other act of the Parliament of Canada, all laws of general application from time to time in force in any province are applicable to and in respect of Indians in the province, except to the extent that such laws are inconsistent with this act or any other order, rule, regulation, or bylaw made thereunder, and may except to that extent that such laws made provision for any matter for which provisions made by or under the act. As a result, the Liquor Act, they held, did not apply under those circumstances. So there's an example of a clear statement that the federal jurisdiction can cover the field, so to speak. An older case as well was the case of Royal Bank versus Scott and the Commissioner of the Northwest Territories. Again, a case that generally speaking has been ignored or commented, well, it predates the UP letter, it's old fashioned, it's out of date, and yet it still, in my submission, is an authority for this proposition. And there the court stated the governing legislation makes it clear that the employees or servants of the territorial government are not employees or servants of the commissioner, although he may hire them and thus pay them, but of Her Majesty. The commissioner as executive office is not the head of the state or government, independent of Her Majesty, but the instrument only, albeit the most important and effective instrument, for relaying and carrying out the instructions that may come down from Her Majesty, the Canadian government, or to him, through ordinances passed through the territorial court. Now, as well, in the Saint-Jean case, the more recent case, Certainly we dealt with the court's comments on the legislative powers of the territory and the role of the commissioner in that capacity, but Mr. Justice Meyer also delineated the function of the commissioner as a civil servant in his administrative capacity. And he held under the Act, that's being the Yukon Act, the chief executive officer is the commissioner appointed by the government council. He is in some ways like a federal civil servant and in his administrative capacity takes instructions from the governor and council or the Minister of Indian Affairs and Northern Development. However, this administrative function must be distinguished from his legislative function. Now, the only major case from the highest court is the City of Yellowknife case of the Supreme Court of Canada. And they were commenting on the legislative powers granted to the Northwest Territories by Section 13 of their Northwest Territories Act, which is similar to Section 17 of our Yukon Act. And here's what the Supreme Court of Canada held. Unlike provincial legislative powers, these are subject to this Act, meaning the Northwest Territories Act, and any other act of the Parliament of Canada. Note must be taken of the limited scope of paragraphs F and S of Section 13 of the Northwest Territories Act as contrasted with Head 10 of Section 92, which would have been of the British North America Act, now the Canada Act. I can see no valid reason for presuming that in enacting the definition of federal works, undertaking, or businesses for the purposes of the Canada Labor Code, Parliament intended that the scope would be restricted to consideration of the extent of the Commissioner's legislative authority in the same way as it is necessarily restricted by consideration of the extent of the province's legislative authority. The subordinate position of the Commissioner was obviously kept in mind. Yet being fairly clear in distinguishing territory's capacity to that of a province, but in case there was any doubt on that, Mr. Justice Borens, in the case of Brian Donald Davies and Neil Stewart Trenholm versus Her Majesty the Queen, dealt with the challenge that certain sections of the Wildlife Act were beyond the powers of the Commissioner and Council because they dealt with the subject of trade and commerce, which was a subject within the legislative competence of the Parliament of Canada. Now, in his decision, Mr. Justice Borens stated, assuming for the purposes of this judgment, that he is correct that Section 29.2 and Section 31.1 purport to regulate trade and commerce in relation to wildlife, the submission of counsel is based on the traditional concept of the division of legislative powers between the federal parliament and the provincial legislatures contained in Sections 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act, 1867. Now, so there's no doubt in anybody's mind, he then goes on to say, as the Yukon Territory is not a province, it follows that Section 91 and Section 92 have no relevance in determining whether or not the legislation is within the legislative competence of the Commissioner and Council of the Yukon Territory. He then commented further, Section 16 of the Yukon Act, in designating specific subjects with respect to which the Commissioner in Council has been granted legislative powers, is comparable to Section 92 of the Constitution Act, 1867. Which defines the areas over which provincial legislatures may exercise legislative powers. However, this is where the comparison ends, and Section 16 of the Yukon Act does not change the status of the Yukon Territory from that of a territory to that of a province. The Parliament of Canada has all-encompassing legislative authority in the Yukon Territory, and this power is neither dependent upon nor limited by the traditional division of powers found in Sections 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act 1867, which have not application to the Yukon Territory. Mr. Justice Borens cited the Canada Labor Relations Board and City of Yellowknife in his decision following the Supreme Court of Canada's position. Now, in the case of Commissioner in Thornton, Mr. Justice Tallis of the Yukon Court of Appeal, as he was then, held that an ordinance of the Yukon Territory came within the definition of an enactment made under an act of the Parliament of Canada. So we've looked first to these judicial pronouncements as, in my submission, extremely clear, strong, and precise opinions as to what a territory is or is not, and more specifically, that we're not a province. But there is also some statutory authority as well, which I'd like to comment on. First of all, the Federal Interpretation Act defines Her Majesty as the sovereign of the United Kingdom, Canada, for other realms and territories, and head of the Commonwealth. Now, the Yukon Interpretation Act uses the same definition. Now, here's an example of a statute, and there's a nice summary of all of the various federal statutes and their interplay, and some treat us differently than others, about how the Yukon is dealt with in the various federal statute in Almstrom's paper. But one example is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Act. Now, that establishes that personal property that is abandoned in the Yukon or Northwest Territories and that comes into the hands of a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and in the course of his or her duties is to be disposed of by the commissioner of the, actually it should be commissioner of the North, the Mounted Police, and proceeds of such disposition are paid into the Consolidated Revenue Fund of Canada. Now, Almstrom, in his paper, The Development of Greater Self-Government in the Yukon Territory, Legal and Constitutional Aspects, written and presented in 1979, commented, elsewhere in Canada, the Sheets and Bonavacantia belong to the Crown and right of the province in which they are found, although the real question may depend on the locus of legislative jurisdiction over the property concerned. In the Yukon Territory, however, the notion seems to prevail that there is no crown and right of the Yukon Territory, and that for all purposes, the prerogative of the Crown is represented by Her Majesty in right of Canada. You also go through the function of the minister in the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development Act, another federal statute. The minister is responsible for undertaking, promoting, and recommending policies and programs for the further economic and political development of the Yukon Territory and the Northwest Territories. Unlike a provincial legislature, the Yukon legislature is required in passing legislation that it be subject to the Yukon Act and any other act of Parliament. No such limitation exists with respect to provinces. The disallowance is much stronger, although there is disallowance powers for the provincial legislatures. Another point, Section 32.1A of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms states that the Charter applies to the Parliament and Government of Canada in respect to all matters within the authority of Parliament, including all matters relating to the Yukon Territory and Northwest Territories. Section 32.1B states that it applies to the legislature and government of each province in respect to matters within the authority of the legislature of each province. Why did the drafters of the Charter not separate the Yukon and Northwest Territories from coming under the authority of province and consider the territories as similar to the provinces? It was appear that the consensus was that the authority of Parliament clearly included jurisdiction over the Yukon Territory. Now, in reviewing over 100 cases dealing with the Charter and its application to the Yukon and Northwest Territories through the Quick Law Database Dominion Report Series, very few deal with 32.1A and 32.1B. Hogg, in his commentary, does not offer any explanation. Territories came under the authority of Parliament. I think the conclusion is so simple. It was just understood by everybody. There was no doubt in the matter. Therefore, it's not something that even has to be discussed. The commissioner takes instructions from the minister. The commissioner is not a lieutenant governor. The Yukon Act can be amended at any time by Parliament. That would include the abolition, perhaps, of the Yukon Territory or radical changes to the legislative powers. There are no guarantees that the Yukon Act could not be changed. There's no guarantees that would say that the F letter could not be rescinded tomorrow. There are no constitutional overriding guarantees that preserve and protect the territories. Now, how can it be said, therefore, that the Yukon government in and of itself has enough of a sovereign status to be considered Her Majesty the Queen and Right of the Yukon, unfettered by parliamentary control? The commissioner remains the chief executive officer. There's strong arguments to suggest that the executive branch of the Yukon government is not the crown and does not have the attributes of a province. Even Almstrom, in his paper, concedes that the commissioner is probably not a direct personal representative of Her Majesty, in his comments. Also, there's the Pfeiffer case where Mr. Justice Tallis, that was a challenge under the Northwest Territories Municipal Act for extending the time for an order pertaining to an election. And the first argument was it should be in federal court. The second argument was that the commissioner was acting as an agent or servant of the Crown. And it held that the specific point was there was jurisdiction in the Supreme Court of the Northwest Territories and that the commissioner was not a federal board, a commission, or tribunal. Now, that doesn't change things in my submission. Now, I'd like to turn to, briefly, arguments that the Yukon government can claim to be the crown. Now, you've got your two decisions of Regina versus Lynn Holdings and Regina versus Chamberlain, which clearly hold that the Yukon government has limited forms of self-government. You've also got the Saint Jean case, where Mr. Justice Meyer concluded that the Yukon government was not a department of the federal government, but he used the term rather an infant province with most of the attributes of a true province. Now, he uses the arguments that Eliot uses and that Almstrom uses, which is there must have been a reason that the Yukon Act, the powers given to the legislature, were similar to those given to provinces under the Canada Act. And he relied on the fact that they were virtually identical. He commented that all acts adopted by the Yukon government may be disallowed by the Governor General. That could also occur with respect to acts of provincial legislatures. And he said that one of the main differences between provinces and territory and a territory was the fact that in creating provinces, the federal parliament irrevocably divested itself of certain powers. Now, I also deal with the Pokiak and Steen case, about whether or not you still have to lay both, you have to lay your legislature enactments, your statutes of the territories before both houses of parliament, and it appears that you do not. It's a directory, not a mandatory requirement. Now, I want to turn to what Eliot says. He argues that the duty of the commissioner does not establish a role different from that of the executive responsibilities conferred on the lieutenant governor. Quote, in most respects, the commissioner remains the effective as well as the formal head of the executive branch of the territorial government. The commissioner remains very much an agent or representative of the federal government. The commissioner still lacks the status of representative of the sovereign in the territory. He also discusses how the Yukon falls short of provincial status. Before the end of the 19th century, it was established in the courts of law that the lieutenant governor of the Canadian province was as much a formal representative of Her Majesty as was the Governor General. The Commissioner of the Yukon Territory presently acts informally as a representative of Her Majesty, but has not yet been accorded formal recognition as such in the courts of law. Now, Almstrom puts forth the argument at some length that the Yukon Act is analogous to the Canada Act, and that one can argue by analogy that the role of the Commissioner is similar to the role of the Lieutenant Governor. He observes that the commissioner has functions similar to the lieutenant governor in areas such as the commissioner's involvement in the summoning of the assembly, his power to take oaths of allegiance from elected members, the fact the commissioner is appointed by the governor and council, and is required to take oaths very similar to those required of lieutenant governors. Now, he was writing in 1979
apart from general broad constitutional cases, as far as UConn commentaries on what a territory was only relying on R versus Chamberlain and R versus Lynn Holdings. He does not comment on the City of Yellowknife case or the Peters case. He argues that because powers have been delegated to the UConn government to legislate in certain areas, that as a result of such delegation, it is implied that executive powers have also been granted. He says, there is therefore nothing more standing in the way of the application of ordinary constitutional principles to the territorial government than the limits placed on government powers by the UConn Act. It is rather too often said that the constitutional development of the UConn has reached a standstill because there has been created no such entity as the Crown in right of the Yukon Territory. Where terms such as these are used, however, they denote legally nothing more than the division of Her Majesty's executive authority empowered to exercise her rights and to fill her responsibilities in relation to the matters concerned. However, to say that because legislative powers have been delegated by statute, that with those powers is also implied the standing of a province, in my submission, is quite a quantum leap. It's a position not recognized by the Supreme Court of Canada. It would appear that the legislative enactments of the federal crown must be passed to achieve this. A municipality is also a legislative statutory body, and yet no one would suggest that such a body is also the crown. Now, the Yukon government has two further authorities to support its position as the crown they could possibly use. One is that the Federal Interpretation Act defines province to mean a province of Canada and includes the Yukon Territory and Northwest Territories. It also defines Lieutenant Governor to mean in relation to the Yukon or the Northwest Territories, the Commissioner. The second authority you can find in the case of Brannigan versus the Yukon Medical Council and the comments of the court in that case. So there's no doubt that under the authority of the Saint-Jean case, the Yukon is not a department of the Government of Canada. It's an infant province. You've got Elliott's points of view, you've got Almstrom's points of view, but is that enough in all of those arguments to establish that the Yukon is in fact a crown? Could argue that it has crown status, which would imply a province. In my submission, the answer is no. And there are further points in my paper that cover why, in my submission, it's just not far enough. We need statutory enactments of the federal government to clearly do this, and we may not be able to even have those, possibly now as a result of if Meech Lake goes through. Now, the paper also deals with what happens if the Crown still argues, or the Yukon government, that they are a Crown, and they have the prerogatives of the Crown, and you need permission to sue. Of course, there's the charter. We were doing a charter challenge in the Rao case when that issue was settled. There's also the concept, and you'll see in the paper that I've dealt with the history of the Fiat in England, statutory enactments of the United Kingdom Crown in the 1860s that dealt with the Fiat and permission to sue government and that procedure. And there's all the concept of the law of England in 1870 by way of the Northwest Territories Act and the law of the Northwest Territories in 1898 being adopted as Yukon law, and there are those points discussed in my paper as well. Because time constraints, it's in the paper. I think that is, as far as I can see, those are all the authorities for and against the proposition that I can come across. There's been no overriding authority that I've come across that has done this, that has taken a look at the pros and the cons in some fashion, and hopefully this paper will be of assistance in this continuing debate. So I think the presentation being finished, I think Gordon wants to do a few minutes of question and answer and discussion. If not, we'll move on to the next one.
That's quite right. Thank you very much, Bruce. Are there any questions or any
Any comments from anybody?
Bruce, when you're raising this issue of Bonham and the Kantian as cheats, as a, not supporting the concept of a crown up here, I understand the argument what you're making. You're saying that because the Yukon doesn't have those, in other words, if someone dies intestate up here, it would go to the federal crown. That supports your position? Whereas that's distinct from what happens in the provinces?
Well, I guess the simple answer is until, in all, looking at a number of the federal statutes, you've got to look at what, how they treat their rights. What statutory authority in Yukon would suggest how the Yukon government establishes, I mean, there are some contradictions to this position. There are some examples and some concrete examples of the Yukon government having crown functions. I guess the point is there's no clear-cut demarcation point. It's got some of the attributes of a crown, but it is not a crown. I mean, Murray, I was focusing more on the crown. On the Escheats issue, perhaps the Department of Justice can help me. I understood that you did enact an Escheats Act in the last few years, and what was the status of that?
You mean the Escheats application?
Yeah.
About 3 months ago.
What happened?
It went through.
On behalf of which queen?
Pardon?
Which crown?
Federal crown.
I can't hear you.
I believe that Ms. Wills mentioned that the government of America has territory to take the position that the Crown, or the government is the Crown in the Northwest Territory. This is not an official position as yet. The government is in the process of reviewing its constitutional strategy and constitutional development for the future, and this is an aspect that will be part of that review. And in the meantime, the indicia of the crown, or the concept of the crown, the existence of the crown in the Northwest Territory is something that little by little will ultimately be there. You said there are elements in the Yukon government that show that it's exercising the crown rights, exercising the crown prerogative. And this is sort of what our intention is to do as well in the Northwest Territory, but it is not yet being done, it's just in the process of developing.
Is there a position of the Northwest Territory government that is not the crown then?
Pardon me?
Is your position that you are not the crown?
No.
Is the position that you are the crown?
Yeah.
Okay.
We just have to find a good way to explain it, that's all.
Well, are there any authorities, other than the ones that I've covered, that would support the position of the Northwest Territory government?
Perhaps no more authorities, but certainly different ways of looking.
Professor Gibson.
I just wondered, and I may well have missed this, Bruce, in the presentation, but I was just looking, perhaps for the first time in my life, I'm not sure, at Section 14 of the Constitution Act, 1867, which has to do with delegation of crown power. And I was quite surprised by the generality of the language, and I just, maybe you can tell me how this fits. Says, it shall be lawful for the Queen, if her Majesty thinks fit, to authorize the Governor General from time to time to appoint any person or any persons, jointly or severally, to be his deputy or deputies within any part or parts of Canada, and in that capacity to exercise during the pleasure of the Lieutenant Governor such powers, authorities, and functions of the Governor General as the Governor General deems necessary and expedient, blah, 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 blah. Is it possible to see some of the legislative enactments, perhaps even the Interpretation Act? Although, no, this has to be an executive delegation. Is there an executive, is there anything that the Governor General might have done by way of assigning powers to the Commissioner that could be seen as fitting within Section 14? If so, then they might be able to formally regard them as powers.
Well, to my knowledge, all of the devolution has been done. The classic example is what was done with the Epp letter. And I understand that the Bassford letter set up similar. It's come from the minister.
They weren't done under the authority of the Governor General.
I don't believe that. The Epp letter clearly is directed, Jake Epp, to the commissioner. It does not come by way of the Governor General.
Yeah.
I think the real problem is how much delegation can continue in this fashion without a statutory enactment, or how much delegation can go before the provinces start screaming, we don't want anymore. We don't want, I think the real problem is, I think the provinces do not want the territories to be provinces.
Oh, sure. But my point simply was that it seems to me that Section 14 allows it to be done by order of council without legislative authority, if I'm reading it right. Bruce,
yeah. One of the points you made is that the Yukon government doesn't have any, I suppose, constitutional basis because of the way that the Yukon Act is set up. They don't have any exclusive legislative competence. That was their mere delegatee, I suppose, of the federal government. But can't that same analogy be made with respect to the federal government? That is, at least prior to the Canada Act, wasn't it a mere delegatee of the Imperial Parliament?
Yes, and that's what Mr. Justice Meyer says. And you know, I think the one in the paper doesn't do, you know, there's only a certain, you know, covered the present authority. We did not deal with the, for example, the constitutional development of colonies and how they became de facto self-governing entities free from imperial constraint.
Well, no doubt the federal government had sovereign powers under the VNA Act. And what's the distinction between the two acts? In other words, why can you suggest that one of the reasons that the Yukon government isn't sovereign is because they don't have any exclusive legislative competence and that the Yukon Act can be repealed at any time? The same argument applies with respect to the VNA Act as well.
Yeah, that may be one of the arguments that could be developed by the Yukon government. I'm not saying that the door is closed. I'm not saying that the area is free from pitfalls, because there are clear examples of the Yukon government being treated as a province. There are clear examples of the Yukon government having, from time to time, or in certain areas, a crown status. But the parts of the whole do not make the whole. And I'm certainly not saying the door is closed for some good arguments being put forward now or at a later date by either territory government that they indeed should be considered to be the crown. I just listed what I thought were some of the pros and cons of the argument.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Bruce. That was very interesting. I can tell you that despite your compelling arguments, the Department of Justice here feels that there is a crown right in the Yukon. We'll read your paper with interest.